The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Each generation before us sacrificed. They confronted their challenges. They embraced their opportunities. And for over two centuries, each generation has left the next better off than themselves. Now the time has come for us to do the same.
Tonight is a victory for every American who's watched in dismay as career politicians in Washington, in both parties, refused to listen and too often failed to keep their commitments to the people.
That our government, the government of our great country, belongs to all of us and not just a handful of billionaires. When that happens, we will transform this country.
I will always work to achieve the America that I believe in, where the promise of that dream that we hold out to our children and our grandchildren never fades, but inspires generations to come.
But we've had so many different indications and polls that we beat her, and we beat her easily, and we will go on to get the Republican nomination, and we will go on to easily beat Hillary or Bernie.
Well, we've been down this road before, for sure. So much optimism, so much confidence, so much bold talk. Leaders who have the solutions, who just need to replace the current ones in office and then proceed with transforming the United States into something so much better. And that's, of course, necessary because 70% of Americans are unhappy with the direction of the United States. They're unhappy with Washington. They're unhappy with the politicians. They're unhappy with the White House. And so now is our chance, finally, to fix everything. Haven't we been down this road before? It was just a little over a year ago that many were saying, and at least on the Republican side, that we could now save the country. The Republicans in 2014, they won in a landslide, taking over the Senate together with the House then. A dominant majority. And yet look at how quickly the optimism surrounding the 2014 campaign, it's just completely evaporated away. We keep seeing this lesson play out every 2 or 4 years. Go back to 2008. You're very familiar with that cycle. When Americans selected a man that one commentator admitted the media hadn't even vetted. And yet people got swept up into the idea that he was the solution to all of America's problems. That he would bring the races together. That he would unite the parties. I want to take you back to a little bit from that victory speech in 2008. This is Senator Barack Obama in Chicago.
The road ahead will be long. Our climb will be steep. We may not get there in 1 year or even in one term. But America, I have never been more hopeful than I am tonight that we will get there. I promise you, we as a people will get there.
Never more hopeful. Many, many promises associated with that campaign. We'll get there. And then, of course, the familiar chant, yes, we can. And you can see why people were so optimistic, so supportive. I mean, after all, the promises included peace in the Middle East, cutting poverty in half, world poverty. Fixing America's inner cities? Fixing the immigration problems? Boosting the economy? Doing away with nuclear weapons? Solving the problems in Afghanistan and Iraq? Crushing Al-Qaeda? Finally stamping out those worst strains of terrorism? This is what we wrote at the time. Late 2008, I believe it was. TheTrumpet.com, we can expect events swiftly to expose the fact that no mortal man, even one assuming the highest office in the world's most powerful country, could ever fulfill the hope that people have invested in this individual. That was about Barack Obama. All the hope that people had invested in that one man. And so here is where we are today, almost 8 years later, 2016. And we have a whole new crop of candidates. One candidate who probably wouldn't even be considered as a serious candidate if things were more normal. But because there's so many people in America who are unhappy and just disgusted with the whole system, here it's given rise to outsider candidates. Will they solve the problems in America? Or what if the Americans stay with the Democrat side? Two candidates there who, well, in the case of one, Americans don't trust her. And the other one, an avowed socialist. How confident are you in this process? How optimistic are you in man's ability to solve the problems that we've brought on ourselves? Herbert Armstrong wrote about the governments of men in his book, The Wonderful World Tomorrow. He said, too often what we find is selfish, greedy men and excessive vanity, ambitious in their lust for rule, scheming to get their hands on the throttle of power for personal aggrandizement and monetary gain. We find secret deals, graft, immorality, deception, dishonesty. It all runs rampant in high places. And then he says, governments promise peace, but they bring wars. This is Herbert Armstrong writing, it must have been early on, with the first version of the Wonderful World Tomorrow book, what, back in the 1950s or 60s? All the promises of government. They promise benefits for the people, and then extract from the people the cost of the benefits plus excessive costs of government. That was another promise in 2008. Everyone's taxes reduced. Everyone's taxes. Solving the poverty problem. Making it easier on the average citizen of the United States. Mr. Armstrong said government promises are empty. The people are the pawns who fork over the money in order to get a part of it back. He said, we fail to find in human government any knowledge of life's purpose or dissemination of true values. Have you heard anything about that in this seemingly endless campaign season in the United States of America? Any knowledge of life's purpose? Any dissemination of true values is candidates galore try to come up with the perfect soundbite to get just the right amount of attention so that they can boost their polling numbers? Anything there about life's purpose or about the dissemination of true values? In Isaiah chapter 2, verse 17, it says, and the loftiness of man shall be bowed down and the haughtiness of men shall be made low, and the Eternal alone shall be exalted in that day. The haughtiness of man. You thought it was bad, the vain haughtiness of man in 2008. Think about some of the statements that Americans have heard in this campaign season. It just gets worse. The vanity. God says in Leviticus 26, we've referred to this here recently, about breaking the pride of our power. And then in that same chapter, there's all kinds of other verses about curses setting in. Look at America's weakening position in the world today. We'll get more into this in the second segment. One disastrous fail after another. God's trying to teach us a lesson. Verse 11 in Isaiah 2 says, "The lofty looks of man shall be humbled, and the haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and the eternal alone shall be exalted in that day." That's what we need more of. Exalting God. Exalting the authority, the preeminence, the power, the mighty hand of God. Instead, we ignore God. And we place our faith in mere mortals, human beings, who make promises they know they'll never be able to keep. Look at Isaiah chapter 1. This chapter here just talks about the sickness in Israel, the descendants of Israel, of course, being not just the little nation of Judah, but the United States and Britain as well. You can study more into that in Mr. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. But here in Isaiah 1 and verse 2, it says, "Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Eternal has spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me." Children who have rebelled against their father, their maker, their God. It says, "The ox knows his owner, and the ass his master's crib, but Israel does not know. My people do not consider." God compares us to cows and oxen who, at least they know their owners. But we've lost all knowledge of who and what God is. We've left God out of the picture. We've left God out of the equation. That's why, as Mr. Armstrong said, you don't hear human government talk about anything having to do with the knowledge of life's purpose. They're not out there disseminating true values. They're out there recycling the same old, tired policies and principles that they think will fix it this time around. One more time. Just one more cycle. Just give us a Ronald Reagan or an Abraham Lincoln. President Obama had a lot of references to Lincoln back in those victory speeches of 2008 and 9. He was the second coming of Lincoln. Lincoln faced a country that was divided, and so did President Obama. And so everything was going to come together. That was the plan. Verse 4, "Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors. They have forsaken the Eternal. They have provoked the Holy One of Israel unto anger. They are gone away backward." See, really, I mean, the leaders have their part to play in this turn away from God. But God puts the blame really on all of us, the people, not just the leaders. The real problem's with the people. The real problem is with sin. Last week, I believe it was the Friday program, when we went through, or at least I referred to, those two verses in Isaiah 59, verses 1 and 2, about how that our sins have separated us from God. Our sins have cut us off from God. It's not that God's hand is shortened and that he can't reach out and help us and solve our problems. But we've cut ourselves off from God because of sin, as it says here in verse 4, because of corruption. And so decay and ruin have set in. Everyone's gone along with it too. There's a verse in Exodus 23 about following a multitude to do evil. Everyone goes along on the road to ruin. Verse 5 says, "Why should you be stricken anymore? You will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick. The whole heart faint." It says, "From the sole of the foot, even unto the head, there's no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. They've not been closed, neither bound up, neither mollified with ointment." Here God compares our entire society to a sick individual who's sick from head to toe. Now again, you can understand this if you dig into the prophecies of God, like Leviticus 26, as I said, if you just have a basic understanding of what it says in verses like 2 Corinthians 4:4, that Satan's the god of this world. Why is it every 2 or 4 years, Americans repeat the same cycle of the past? Just get rid of these bums. Just get rid of the ones that fill the White House or Congress now. And replace them with candidate A, B, or C. And voila, everything's solved. Problem solved. Problems fixed. And through it all, the problems just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. When will we accept our responsibility or our part in causing these problems? When will we accept it's not just another leader that will fix everything? Well, eventually, more and more Americans, more and more Britons will have to face up to the facts as they look at all this ruin. More and more, we're surrounded by it. You see the broken will, you see the lawless leaders, you see social breakdown in our streets, you see racial strife and tension like never before. You see America's and Britain's enemies on the rise. So, and together with all this, so many economic problems and curses. God's bringing it all upon us to help us look at ourselves. These are problems that are not going to be fixed by the political process, by campaign seasons, by a more conservative or a more liberal president, by a more conservative or a more liberal Congress. God's trying to show us that we've turned our backs on him. He wants us to turn back to him. Turn you. Turn you. Why will you die, Israel? And that's what he said through one of his prophets. Why? Why die when you can turn to God in repentance and reestablish contact with God and tap into that source of divine power? As we discussed on the show last week, when we come back, we'll look at a pretty amazing editorial in the Washington Post from a couple of days ago about the failure of this deal we struck with Cuba just a little over a year ago. Pretty amazing piece. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream can be found at thetrumpet.com and at kpcg.fm. we have time later today, we'll get into a few more emails that came in response to yesterday's show. Send those emails to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
To America's founding fathers, character meant everything to the success of the nation and its leadership. The Constitution was based upon the fundamental principles of religion and morality. These were the primary building blocks of the American nation. George Washington said, "The foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality." Character was no minor issue to America's first president. He regarded it as the basis of national policy. Where did the founding fathers develop these ideas? Many of these principles stemmed from the Holy Scriptures. The Bible provided early Americans with the instruction and guidance of how to properly govern one's life. These beliefs helped build a nation of strong families and upright leaders. Today, America has dismissed the Bible as the foundation of developing righteous character. Men now leave it to themselves to determine right from wrong. Where has the rejection of biblically based principles led this nation? There is a cause for these effects. To understand the course of events that have led this nation to its current state, visit thetrumpet.com and click on the Literature tab to request our free booklet, Character in Crisis.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Well, and speaking of campaign promises or grandiose assurances coming from the political class, it seems as if the window between the promises and then when the facts roll in that powerfully demonstrate that those promises have been broken, it just gets shorter and shorter. You can take Cuba as one example. It was just a little over a year ago, December 2014, when President Obama reestablished full diplomatic relations with the Castro regime in Cuba. We of course, were all over this story at thetrumpet.com, talking extensively about the hand that the Pope had in this deal, Pope Francis, and going back to Cuba's important history before the Castro regime came along, and just how critical it is to the Holy Roman Empire, going back centuries. In any event, let me just take you back again to some of the statements that were made early on in this deal with Cuba, and deal doesn't even really describe it the right way, because it was so one-sided. It was the United States basically giving up everything and receiving nothing in return. In any event, here's how President Obama announced the deal on December 17th, 2014.
"Today, the United States of America is changing its relationship with the people of Cuba in the most significant changes in our policy in more than 50 years. We will end an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests, and instead, we will begin to normalize relations between our two countries. Through these changes, we intend to create more opportunities for the American and Cuban people and begin a new chapter among the nations of the Americas."
And so that new chapter started just a little over a year ago, and this deal was intended to, among other things, create more opportunities for the Cuban people. It was to advance American interests. That's what was said early on during the flag-raising ceremony in Cuba. Later, this would have been August 14th, 2015. This is what Secretary of State John Kerry said.
"For now, the president has taken steps to to ease restrictions on remittances, on exports and imports to help Cuban private entrepreneurs, on telecommunications, on family travel, but we want to go further. The goal of all of these changes is to help Cubans connect to the world and to improve their lives. And just as we are doing our part, we urge the Cuban government to make it less difficult for their citizens to start businesses, to engage in trade, access information online.
And that's the thing. That's what the United States hoped, that it would help private entrepreneurs, telecommunications and so on, family travel. And they urged that. That's what we got in return. Well, we urged Cuba, the government, to make it less difficult for their citizens to start businesses, engage in trade, and so on. Now you come to the Washington Post editorial, this piece that was printed January 31st, failure in Cuba. Failure. Now, that didn't take but a year. Failure in Cuba. Of course, whether or not it's failure, I think, depends on what, well, which side you're on and what President Obama was trying to achieve from the get-go anyway. I mean, sure, in his mind, and I'm sure in Secretary of State John Kerry's mind, it's still seen as a tremendous success because, well, the way they view it, 53 or 54 years, whatever it was, of severed ties, that didn't accomplish anything. It was about to bring the Castro regime down. But the way the administration viewed it, it wasn't accomplishing anything, and so, well, let's just restore the friendship. Let's just befriend them and hope that it will really advance the nation and advance or help the people of Cuba. And this is, again, this is an editorial piece from the Washington Post editorial board. This is the left-wing Washington Post talking about the deal with Cuba. They write, President Obama's opening to Cuba seems to be failing to live up to its declared goals. When the end to a half century of hostility was announced in December 2014, the proclaimed U.S. purpose was to unleash the potential of 11 million Cubans. That's a direct quote from the White House fact sheet. It was to, quote, engage and empower the Cuban people. It was to, quote, empower the nascent Cuban private sector, among other things. And then the Post says, yet there's scant evidence so far of a sea change in Cuba, perhaps because Mr. Obama continues to offer the Castro regime unilateral concessions, requiring nothing in return. Let me just read that last statement again. This is the Washington Post commenting on President Obama's foreign policy. It says, Mr. Obama continues to offer the Castro regime unilateral concessions, requiring nothing in return. Now, if that sounds familiar, it's because it is. It should. It should sound familiar. That's the exact same approach that it took in its deal with Iran. Nothing in return. Not even the guarantee that Iran would never get a nuclear weapon. Just unilateral concessions, requiring nothing in return. And then the Post, with respect to Cuba, goes on to describe many of these concessions and how that it's not helped the Cuban people. It says, since the United States has placed no human rights conditions on the opening, the Castro regime continues to systematically engage in arbitrary detention of dissidents and others who speak up for democracy. In fact, detentions have spiked in recent months. Those pro-democracy voices in Cuba, they're being silenced. Even as relations have been restored, diplomatic relations have been restored between the United States and Cuba. It says the state continues to monopolize radio, television, and newspapers. See, you go back to some of those grandiose statements and promises Was it really about freeing that country, freeing the Cuban people from a socialist dictatorship? Was that what it was really about at the start? Or was it just simply about appeasing America's enemies? The Post says the administration has defined one of its goals as opening Cuba to the internet, but the nation still suffers from some of the lowest connectivity rates in the world. And then it talks about the exorbitant cost to get connected because of this autocratic regime. The Castro regime, worth about $1 billion, by the way. And then there's the people. And then there's the Cuban people that can't get connected to the internet, that get thrown in jail if they are proponents of democracy. The Post says the hoped-for explosion in individual enterprise has not materialized either. On the contrary, the number of licensed self-employed workers has been dropping. If there are commercial deals as a result of the latest U.S. measures, it is Cuban state organizations that will benefit. Only they are allowed to engage in foreign trade. It just helps the Cuban state. It just helps the Cuban government. It's all about government. That's why this administration would see the deal as still something that's a tremendous success. Because in the minds of so many left-wing liberals, government is the solution. Government. The ever-expanding government. And of course, there's a kindred spirit there, really. Just because of the animosity that you see in the Cuban government and the current U.S. government toward American institutions, toward American traditions. It says, what's most evident over the past year is that the Castro brothers are effectively preventing real change and reform, even as they reap the rewards of Mr. Obama's opening. This is the Washington Post, keep in mind. This is now transparently obvious. This is evident, clearly evident. Let me just read it again. What's most evident over the past year is that the Castro brothers are effectively preventing real change and reform, even as they reap the rewards of Mr. Obama's opening. Again, very similar to what's happened with Iran. Many rewards to reap. And no real change that takes place. The president's only response has been more unilateral concessions. Can you believe that? This has been the response. Even when these autocratic regimes refuse to make changes, refuse to reform, what's the response? Time and time again. More concessions, more freebies, more gifts, more money. It says autocrats everywhere must be watching. They must be watching with envy as the Castro's good fortune, or rather at the Castro's good fortune. I mean, to me, it's a little bit shocking to just see the Washington Post write about something that's just kind of obvious now after you look at it 12, 13 months on from the deal being finalized. All of those promises, more opportunity, a new chapter, better for the entrepreneurs, better for the telecommunications industry, more connectivity to the internet. It's just a way to help Cubans connect to the world, don't you know? Well, as I said, when all of this was playing out early on, in fact, we had a lot to say, and it wasn't so much focused on how that this was going to be a bad deal for the Cuban people, although we did say that too. My father said, this is a bad deal for the Cubans, okay? It is. He said that back in March. He said it before that, I believe, on his TV program. It's a bad deal. It's not going to help them. Being nice to the Castro brothers, that's not going to help them or encourage them to make reforms. They're going to crack down harder on their people. Now that they've gained international legitimacy, now that they've gained more funding, now that their economy has been rescued. But the bigger development that we discussed in this deal had to do with the Vatican being behind it. Well, let me just go to that March 2015 Trumpet article. It says, under the Castros, the people of Cuba have suffered political terror and human rights abuses. Fidel and Raul Castro have run the nation as a totalitarian police state, and they continue to model it after the Soviet Union. Cubans are the only people in the Western Hemisphere who haven't been able to elect a leader in more than 55 years. It says, when Russia and Venezuela, the main sponsors of the Castro regime, started suffering in the last few months due to falling oil prices, it looked as if the Castro government could finally collapse. Again, you can see some very similar themes from this development and what happened with Iran. Iran was so very close. The regime in Iran was so very close to collapsing. The mullahs were afraid that there might be another uprising because there was so much discontent on the streets. And yet, who swooped in and threw them the lifeline? It was the United States of America in both cases. It says, what the Castro brothers needed in order to survive was an economic lifeline from their enemy, the United States. And that's exactly what the Pope and President Obama delivered. The deal also gave their criminal government international legitimacy. Anybody familiar with the Castro regime's track record knows that legitimizing and propping it up is not in the interest of the people of Cuba. It's not in the interest of the people of Cuba to prop up this dictatorial regime. And so, as my father said, this is a bad deal for the Cubans. This is not going to help the people of Cuba. And it's not going to motivate the Cuban government to reform, to make changes. They're not going to volunteer to give up their power just because of all of these unilateral concessions brought on by the United States. That's what we said. And now, of course, it's been emphatically confirmed just a year later by the Washington Post editorial board. My father said legitimizing it is a victory for those who want to see America fall. Giving in to that communist regime emboldens America's enemies. It's also important that as part of the deal, Cuba released Alan Gross, an American citizen wrongfully imprisoned for 5 years, and the U.S. released 3 Cuban spies. So you may have forgotten, but there was a prisoner swap along with this deal. We got Alan Gross, and they got 3 Cuban spies. And what did we say at the Trumpet? To U.S. enemies, this sends a clear message, a surefire way to win policy concessions from Washington. Or to rescue your friends, captured by the U.S., is to take American citizens hostage and hold them as long as necessary. Does that sound familiar? Well, there was another prisoner swap connected to the Iran nuke deal. And as we covered right here on this program, even right as the swap was being made, 3 more Americans were being kidnapped in Baghdad by an Iranian-backed militia group. America's enemies have gotten the message loud and clear. It's so clear that a surefire way to win concessions from Washington, well, take American citizens hostage and hold on to them as long as is necessary. You talk about cycles that never end. It's just made worse each time around. My father said this place is America's weakness on display for the world to see. It also potentially endangers Americans by putting a price on their heads. For America, this was a disgraceful surrender. It was a disgraceful surrender. Now, even the Washington Post sees it was a total failure. But, of course, you have to look at that word failure in connection to what was the real goal here. What was the real agenda? Did the Obama administration go into this hoping to bring down the regime or to prop it up? Well, I'll let you be the judge of that. If you don't know, maybe you should get our book, America Under Attack. Switching over to this personal, this is more recent, also written by my father. December 2015, Cuba, a threat to America. My father said, this is right at the end of his personal, you need to beware of what's happening in Cuba. This is a dangerous world. America's like a silly dove, walking right into a deadly trap. Cuba isn't dead. Communism isn't dead. And Cuba's reemerging as a clear and present danger to the United States. We need to beware. We need to look at our history. We need to dig into why the Pope and the Vatican would even be interested in helping to make this deal. We need to look at why Europe is going to be taking an interest in Cuba. But even if you just look at the more recent history of Cuba as a communist state, my father went through this in both of those articles, especially the latest one, that personal from December. April 1961, you have the Bay of Pigs. This was America's failed military invasion of Cuba to try to bring down the Castro regime. That was in April 1961. Then in the next year, October 1962, you have the Cuban Missile Crisis. This confrontation between the U.S. and Russia, or the Soviet Union, that very nearly started a world war. And then a year after that, President John F. Kennedy shot dead by Lee Harvey Oswald, a former U.S. Marine who had defected to the Soviet Union in 1959. He returns in 1962, and then the following year, he assassinates a U.S. president. That same president that was there in the White House during the Cuban Missile Crisis. That same president that made the Soviet Union back down. The Washington Times wrote in September last year, 3 days after John F. Kennedy was shot and killed in Dallas, U.S. intelligence officials told President Lyndon B. Johnson that they had confirmed that assassin Lee Harvey Oswald had recently traveled to Mexico City to visit both the Cuban and Soviet embassies, according to a half-century-old briefing memo declassified on Wednesday. It was only declassified last year, but the memo's a half-century old, and it tells us that Lee Harvey Oswald visited the Cuban embassy and the Soviet embassy in Mexico City just 3 days. 3 days after that assassination. Well, that's just recent history. But as President Obama said last year when he announced the deal, you know, all that's water under the bridge. We have a new beginning. We're going forward. We're going to reestablish diplomatic relations between our two nations. And so they did. And has it really brought help and comfort and aid to the Cuban people? Has it really advanced America's interests? Has it made the world safer? Does it make America safer? Well, go back and read those two articles, that personal and the December 2015 trumpet. And then before that, earlier last year, that article that my father wrote in March, The Deadly Dangerous U.S.-Cuba Deal. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond. When we come back with the few minutes that we have left, we'll update you on a couple more developments here at Edstone and read through a few more letters or emails that came in response to yesterday's program. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily.
A turning point in recent history has gone almost entirely overlooked. Since that time, an unseen cause has brought about national and world troubles in unprecedented fashion. Crises are intensifying as never before. In our generation, we are seeing radical changes to culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, international relations. Everything has been affected. You cannot understand events without recognizing this unseen cause. The United States has been shaken in astonishing fashion. Have you wondered why the world's number one superpower is declining so rapidly? Are you concerned about where the current administration is leading this country? The Bible provides penetrating insight into the invisible cause of society's decline. America is prophesied to fall before it rises again. The Bible also gives extraordinary insight into how that fall will come about. This insight puts the seriousness and urgency of current events in their true perspective. Understand what's in store for America and why. Visit thetrumpet.com and click on the Literature tab to request this free, enlightening booklet, America Under Attack.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
I told you recently about a little advertisement that we put on the envelopes that we use here at Edstone to distribute the church literature. It's just a little ad on the outside that advertises the Armstrong College Bible Correspondence Course, and there's a barcode there. You can scan it with your phone, and it'll take you right to the site that you need to go to enroll in the course. And from that week, I guess it was 3, maybe 4 weeks ago, but ever since that time, we've added 5 new students to the course each week. So very nearly one per day, just from a simple ad that's printed on an envelope that probably costs less than a penny to produce. In any event, I've been thinking more. I know I told you at the start of the year I wanted to try to outline some goals for the year in terms of literature distributed. And I just previewed a TV program this morning that was just built around the correspondence course. Actually, the content of the program came from that radio program last Friday, where we talked about tapping into that source of spiritual power and really getting to know God and working on our relationship with God and making our requests known to God and praying prayers of faith and living a life of obedience and understanding God's will. And so the whole program, as I say, it was built around that content, and I think it's the first time we've ever just advertised the correspondence course. And so as I've been thinking about these goals, I don't yet have it outlined, but it's something that you can be thinking about as this TV program will play not this weekend, but the weekend that follows, so in mid-February. And I'll be anxious to see how many people enroll in the course. As I said on that program, we actually brought the whole stack of all 36 lessons and set it on the desk as I was giving the presentation. And as I told the viewers at one point, you can look at that stack and I think be a little bit intimidated by it. You know how it is in this very noisy world today to really commit to something that could potentially take years to complete. But as I said, if you commit to it and are consistent, what a difference, what a change you'll see in your life. It will change your life for the better. It will improve your life. It'll improve your relationship with God. It'll improve your prayer life. Well, I'm not sure what figure we'll settle on, but it is something, as I say, to be thinking about, as I'd like to set a goal perhaps for that course and maybe the United States and Britain in Prophecy, and then again for Mystery of the Ages as well. So if we don't get around to that this week, perhaps next week we can lock those figures in. We'll be earlier on in the year or the calendar year than we were last year when we came out with the mystery goal. I think that was back in May or June of 2015. A couple of email responses. This first one here says, I just want to say a big thank you for your program today. I live in Virginia and listen to your program 5 to 6 times a week through the live stream. So here's one of our live listeners, perhaps listening right now. I've been a subscriber to The Trumpet since 1997. I've followed the court case and all the other events that have occurred since. I now know that based on the evidence, God is truly working through you and your staff. I've watched this work grow by leaps and bounds. I'm completely convinced that you're the little flock. So I sincerely thank God and you and the staff for all that you do. This second one, that was from Virginia, as I said. And this one, I think it's embedded in the message itself, but he writes, what a wonderful work. I'm thankful to write this and share my appreciation about this wonderful radio program, among others. He goes on to talk about how he had been away for a while and then got his life back on track spiritually, and says, thetrumpet.com, this program and literature I've had in the past with God's mighty hand brought me back. Brought him right back to God's work. Brought him right back to the truth. He says, I wanted to share this because my experience made me think how many people are out there and need the encouragement while they wait to come back. The work needs a lot of laborers, as you know. I hope you will tell everyone out there working hard to be in this work to keep fighting. It's worth it. Keep fighting, he says. Don't give up. Don't lose hope. I hope everyone in Edstone keeps hanging in there too. Nowhere is safe today in this world. Fathers, mothers, families, workers, thank you for all that you do. I'm writing from Western NC, I guess that's North Carolina. Have a beautiful week. And then this last email coming in response to yesterday's program, it says, I just heard today's program and how on point you are. I listen to your show 4 to 5 times a week through the internet. I must say that you and your staff have done a marvelous job of researching the facts contained in each program. I eagerly look forward to hearing your radio show. Thank you all for the great job you do in making God's word so plain and relevant to the cataclysmic events we are seeing now. So those are a few more responses coming in from listeners like you, scattered all over the earth, listening in, some of them live, some of them getting the podcast through iTunes or from the trumpet.com website. Whoever you are, wherever you are, however you listen, let us know your story. Send those emails, send that feedback to td@kpcg.fm. That's td@kpcg.fm. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma, our headquarters campus. This program comes to you live from Edstone. You can get the live stream at thetrumpet.com and at kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.